Welcome to Attached, a platform for adding breadth and depth to everyday living. I'm Yaakov Danishevsky, and this is the conversation series focused on my book. In each episode, I invite a special guest to discuss the topic of a particular chapter and how it relates to our lives. Welcome to another conversation episode where we're going to be looking at the third chapter of the book. Today I'm joined by Rabbi Yitzi Horowitz, a new friend of mine, someone who I've known from a distance as a prominent psychotherapist, a prominent lecturer both of Shiurim and of psychology, and somebody that I think is well known in our world. But I've only recently become personally connected, and something I'm very grateful for and looking forward to connecting more. Thank you for making the time to have this conversation with me.
Oh, with pleasure. With pleasure.
Thanks. So we're going to look at the topic in the third chapter of the book, as usual, using that as our springboard for the conversation. And the third chapter, to just very briefly summarize, is about how we meet God. I don't want to say how we meet God, because it's my approach to how I find Hashem. It's certainly not the only one. But the basic premise of the book is the idea that we can actually have a personal relationship with Hashem, with God, and not only a belief in a concept of believing that there's a creator or that there's a higher power or a God, but we can actually experience that connection. And if that's the premise and the whole purpose, really, in a nutshell, of the book, is that we can experience that relationship with Hashem, then what I think that means is that we need to find Hashem through experience. And so what I set out in this chapter is to offer one version of how we can find Hashem through experience, and not only through a world of ideas or a world of tradition, which are both important. The world of ideas are deeply important, and the world of tradition is deeply important, but also through a world of our personal primal experience within ourselves, within our bodies, within our senses, within our feelings, that we can actually experience the presence of this being, which opens the door for a more personal relationship. So Rabbi Horowitz, I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on that type of approach or proposition, that we can actually experience that kind of closeness with God.
Sure. I really wanted to just start by saying to what I said to you on our first phone call, which was a couple of days ago, about how exciting I was to see this book, specifically using very, very modern day concrete language that is both psychological as well as chock full of ideas. I mean, so much of the notes that are, so many of your notes are really, really just like well thought out and presented in a concise and clear readable manner. So I'm not just saying that I appreciated the way the book was written, but the content also was really just like right on target. So I'm
thank
I'm
you so much.
Thank you. You know, one of the things that came to my mind when I read the book was a question that was that's asked by a scientist slash poet whose name is Andrea Weber. And he poses the following question. His question was, who has a more accurate depiction of a forest? The ecosystem of a forest. Who has a more accurate depiction of a forest? A scientist who can explain to you the whole scientific background of how ecosystems work, how the trees provide shade and the chlorophyll and the roots and the soil and the animals that are there and the sunlight and all that stuff, who can explain all that? Or the poet who can sit under a tree and experience whatever radiance and magnificence the poet can experience. Who has a more accurate description of what a forest is? Mm. And he makes the case to say, obviously, that you need to have both. But the scientist who's never experienced the beauty that the poet has experienced cannot know what a forest is. And for me, in reading this particular chapter, that was one of the things that was resonating in the back of my mind, is the question of the capacity to encounter and experience something that is infinite, which simply means something that's unknown. And that unknown really can be full of anxiety, and that unknown can be full of uncertainty, and it can also be full of the opportunity for all different kinds of growth, possibility, excitement, etc. So that's the first, that was the first thought that came to my mind.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And I think really speaks to so much of our lives in terms of the challenge that I know that I've experienced in my life, and I think a lot of people do, of living more in our heads than in our experience. I have in my office a copy of a famous painting in my therapy office. The truth is, I came to it not from knowing art, but I came to it from an article that by Reuven Leichter wrote. I forgot the name of the artist. Forgive me, but the picture is of a man looking in a mirror, and in the mirror, so you're facing this individual, and he's facing the mirror, and you're facing the back of his head, and he's looking into the mirror, and you see in the mirror reflecting back to him the back of his head.
Interesting.
So you don't see, so the idea is that he's seeing what other people are seeing when he's looking in the mirror, but he's not seeing what he's actually seeing.
Right.
Interesting. And there's so much depth to, you know, how you can interpret what that means. But I think one of the very powerful ways is how we often go through life thinking about what we're experiencing instead of experiencing it.
Right. Yeah, certainly. Certainly, certainly, certainly. Yeah, I mean, that kind of brings me to one of the other things I was thinking about is how much a lot of this book and a lot of your attempt, and I think a lot of what a lot of us are looking for is, you know, I personally was raised in an Orthodox from home. I went to Orthodox Jewish yeshivas, and religion was handed to me in a very, very particular format that from day one, I mean, you know, my father reminds me of the story. When we went to Sesame Street Place, you know, out in Pennsylvania once. And I was a little kid, and we were sitting around in a circle, and the character Big Bird asked, "Okay, kids, what's the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning?" And my hand shot up, and they came over to me and they said, "What is the first thing you do?" I said, "I watched Nugglewasser." So that's Big Bird goes, "You did what?" And my father, like, I remember this vision, my father like running over to me, like to try to like stop the interaction, you know? But like, you watch Nugglewasser, I don't know, that's what I do. Like, maybe I say my Da'ani first, I don't know. But like, you know, so there's so much that's handed to us, pre-packaged, pre-formatted, and so much information and so much idea. And then the question becomes, how does that fit with encountering a personal experience of an infinite creator, God, Hashem, like, and how does that, and then how do you take that back into Torah? Like, that's, even forgetting that discussion, but how you take that back into Torah, but how do you begin the process of discovering a God when everything about God has been pre-formatted, packaged, given to you through the multitudes of shiurim that you've heard and the halakhas you've learned and all that kind of stuff. And the idea of whether you're forced by some kind of internal searching or you're just looking for some form of experiencing a being, something beyond. It's like, sometimes it feels like Chas v'Shalom that there, you know, there's the personal God and there's the religious God.
Right.
And how do you make that kind of work?
Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it kind of goes, it reminds me, it goes back to the machlokas, the argument between Yisro and Moshe Rabbeinu, right, with Moshe's sons, right, that Yisro wanted Moshe to raise them in a way that they would be able to just, you know, kind of explore for themselves and arrive on their own, and Moshe said, no, they have to, you know, be raised with the basis and the foundation, and it's interesting because I'm not remembering all the details right now, but I'm trying to remember if somehow, even though we don't follow Yisro's approach, of course, somehow there's a way in which we see that Moshe concedes to it, maybe with one of them, or that there's some way in which Yisro's havamino, Yisro's claim, has some validity, right? So there is something to that, and yet it seems right that if we don't if we don't pass on the basis, then the chance of them finding the personal God is actually even more slim. Yeah. Right.
Right.
So then, so I'm curious. So what would you say? What do you, you know, how do you, for yourself or for clients or Talmidim, how do you help people kind of navigate through this?
I'd rather talk about my kids. You know,
great. Like, yes, that's another option.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's a real question, you know, that I think about all the time. I mean, we have three beautiful children, and each one goes to a separate school, and they're all getting chinuch, and the question becomes, how do I talk about the personal relationship I have with God? How do I talk about how do I experience it, and how do I live it in my house, and leaving room for, like, I have my own personal ways of doing it, and my kids are obviously being raised with my personal way and my wife's personal way and whatever our joint way of doing it is. And at the same time, how do we give them the opportunity to find the freedom to choose and to be interested in choosing? And that's a delicate balance. It really is a delicate balance. I do want to say something about, like, therapy, because that is where I think maybe this question looks a little different for me. A lot of the way that I look at psychotherapy is about, like, developmental stages, like where people are at developmentally. And this is maybe, I'm going to try to express this in the clearest way that I can, but if I get lost in my head, you know, you'll bring me back to it. But, like, I find sometimes when I think about this with clients, like, where does God fit in to the psychotherapy process? Where does God fit in? You know, as, like, you and I talked about, I don't bring God up to most of my clients. I mean, lately I've had more comfortability with it, but generally speaking, I don't. One or two, or maybe a little more than that, are clients that are learning a lot of Musar, learning a lot of Hasidus, and then I'll just, you know, we'll go at it together.
Mm-hmm.
For me, God is found really, really, really in the unknown. And that to me is, I think, going back to something that we were just talking about. For me, when a client looks at their reality, when a person looks at their reality as in the frame that they see it in their life, right here, right now, everything that I know about myself, everything I'm thinking about myself, everything I've experienced, whether it be trauma, whether it be some kind of, you know, arrested development or crisis that's going on in my life right now, my ability to experience myself right now, right here, is in some ways, life is what it is. It just is what it is. There's nothing more, there's nothing less, take it or leave it. And I'm not talking about mindfulness, I'm talking about just the day-to-day experience, the second-to-second experience. What gives me the ability to believe that there's something more? What gives me the ability in this split second to know that this is not all there is, that there is something beyond, and that there is something that's possible more than this? And it brings me back to these words, and I always misquote them, so I'm going to look it up. These words from Rav Kook. It's funny. I knew it before we got on, here we go. Rav Kook writes, I mean, it's based on a medrash. Rav Kook writes, "Kishem sheshvacho shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu olam gan Eden," just like the shvach of HaKadosh Baruch Hu emanates from Gan Eden, "Kachu olam min haGehenim," the shvach of HaKadosh Baruch Hu emanates from Gehenim. "V'sof HaKol," and everything, is in a state of v'sof HaKol lehisalois, everything is always headed towards transcendence, lehismatek, towards sweetening, well, his kadesh, and towards becoming more holy. So we can have a much longer discussion about what it means to be a therapist and how I look at averas and what it means to hit rock bottom and what it means to descend. But the basic idea is that you can go forwards or you can go backwards, but everything is in a state of transcendence and everything is in a state of sweetening. even when it looks like there's, excuse my French, there's hell on earth. I'm living in hell. But kashem shvachu shel kadosh baruch hu oylem gan eden, kach shvachu shel kadosh baruch hu oylem megehenem. So there is this belief or this sense that that's where God is found. In those pockets, in those little tiny moments when I'm able to feel, oh wait, there's something more that's possible, that little tiny feeling to me is the tiniest experience of God.
Hmm.
Now, you don't have to say that that's God, but to me, that's where I find it. When any moment that I am sitting with a client and I see something in their eyes, there's any kind of aha moment or any sense of like, oh, you mean this is not all there is? That to me is where that person's encountered God.
Hmm. Wow. So it's the idea kind of that whatever is apparent right now, whatever is presenting itself, naturally, in a sense, should just be the way it is, and it should just essentially stay the way it is. The fact that we perceive or we connect with a possibility of there being something more or some form of renewal or some form of development or the ability to possibly, potentially reimagine the way we look at something or the way we experience something, any of that potentiality, the potential of potential, any of that is because there's something transcendent to the reality of what of isness, of what is, and that being that and that little that taste of possibility, of potential, that's what's transcendent to the situation right now. And that possibility is an inkling almost as if of that which is actually infinite and is what gives the potentiality of moreness to what is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, years ago, I was very interested in looking at the difference between oblivion and infinity.
Hmm.
You know, addicts search and search and search and search, and they end up in oblivion. And the 12-step idea of, you know, you're not looking in the right place, but you're looking for something more and beyond.
You're
looking for infinity. So how do you know when you're looking for, when you're stuck in oblivion and when you're touching infinity? It's like the Gemara has a lashon of ein ledavar seif, right? That's oblivion.
Hmm.
And we, in our tradition, that Mekubalim referred to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as ein seif, right? So there's Ein Ledavar Seif and there's Ein Seif. It's like oblivion and infinity. And how do you really tell the difference between those two things? It's you can play with it in your mind, but
that's pretty incredible, actually. Can we go a little bit with that? Maybe sure. I mean, maybe this is what you're saying sure. already, but Ein sure. Ledavar Seif versus Ein Seif is, are you giving Ein Sof, are you giving infinity to a Davar, to something that's tangible, versus Ein Sof is about, as you said before, something that's actually, Ein Sof is not even referring to an object. There's no davar. So the difference between infinity and oblivion is if you're giving that level of power to something that's an object, that's a davar, that's oblivion. When you're giving that type of infinity to something and you're allowing it to remain unknown, that's infinity.
Precisely. That's precisely where I was going.
Yeah,
it's you know, like, right. So I often do long-term psychotherapy, and at this stage I think I'm sure that there are many therapists that have gotten clients that have left me, and I get clients of people that have left other therapists. And sometimes as I watch people descend into a real dark place, they've tried everything. They've tried the money, they've tried spirituality, they've tried religion, they've tried all kinds of addictive behaviors and substances, they've tried status. All the dvarim of their lives has been Ein Ledavar Seif. And to get to a place within of Ein Seif means that you realize it's not about anything. It really is about that nukuda that's within each and every one of us, that is chelik elikami mal mamish, that is ein soif. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to have some deep mystical experience and use psychedelics or have all deep Kabbalistic kavanas, but it is about switching our focus from things and sometimes from, you know, practices, rituals, to switch the focus from there to, I need to focus on the isness, the being, right? The feminine sense of just being and being held and being contained and recognizing the dignity of me, who I am, what I am, not for anything and not totally on anything, but just the isness of me. That to me is where we find the capacity to see the potential of everything. So the funny way of saying it is, right here, right now is where Hashem is completely. But if I'm not finding that, then I have to see the potential of what can be. And through that, I get back to right this moment of, like, it's not oblivion, it's infinity. And infinity is packed into the tiniest little nothing, and it's also expanded into everything.
I need like a good long moment to sit with this Ein Sof versus Ein Ladover Sof. That's really, really incredible. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I guess I'm wondering about a person who is in a situation and doesn't sense that unknown potential. They don't feel like they can see that. And how when we're in that, I forget talking about a person, we're all there sometimes. So how when we are there, when I'm there, how do we reconnect? Because sometimes it feels natural. It presents itself naturally to us, even when we're down. But the potential, at least, or the potential of potential just appears. But then sometimes it's like it just feels like it's nowhere to be found.
So I think different things work for different people, and different things work at different times for different people. I can share with you what I do for myself.
Please.
You know, the word deep can mean two different kinds of things. It can mean deep down in a deep dark place. And it can also mean the depth of something, which is where we find more beauty. I guess the way that I've come to experience these things is that it really is one and the same. And that if I push on the bottom of the lowest moments, you can pop out to the other side and find what's underneath. And what's underneath is an neshama. And to me, when those moments, when I get to those moments and I get to sense that my life is either going in the wrong direction or I'm falling apart or like I'm just stressed out and like I'm stuck in something, for me it's about going down. It's about going deep, not necessarily in averas, but it just means like let myself fall apart and then be caught on the other side by, like, you know, as Rabbi Nachman said, this Ein Shum Yesh Ba'olam, you quoted in your book, but it's like mamish. It's really, really true. Like at the bottom of the bottom of the bottom, like that's where your neshama is. Now, we're not meant to live in the bottom of the barrel. We're meant to live expressed and living in this world and engaging with people and have jobs and have things that we do and be creative and all that stuff. But there are times when we have to stop and just go back down to a sense of, I'm going to let go of everything I've done. I'm going to let go of all the good I've done. I'm going to let go of all the good intentions I have and all the goals that I have and all the things that I'm involved in doing and all the relationships that I have, all the things I'm connected to, all the things about my personal character traits. And I literally will do this like as a meditation for myself. I'll go through all of these layers until I'm like stripped everything away and I'm back down to a certain sense of, I need to reconnect with my own significance. I matter. And I matter because I'm a Bria. I've been created by Hashem. My existence is not for a mission. My existence is because Hashem wants me to be here. That's it. It's an act of love. That's my purpose on this planet. And that's it. And to bring myself back down to that place of being able to let it go, strip it all away, and then restart the engine somehow. You know? That's what works for me.
It's not to just be so repetitive, but it really is. It's speaking to me again on this getting rid of the davar. So it's moving from the ein ledavar sof to the ein sof, right? It's the davar is all the things I've become attached to, and I'm getting rid of that and going to the basic, which is the ein sof itself.
Right.
So it's very counterintuitive though, right? Like, help me speak this out, because typically when we feel down in that kind of a way, we don't lean into the feeling down. We try and pull ourselves up.
Right.
But what you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, is actually kind of let yourself fall all the way down, almost intentionally.
Right. So I know that it sounds counterintuitive, and I don't necessarily recommend this. Like, you know, I could just tell you what works for me. You know, I've found some of this in the writings of the Kamarna. Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Mekamarna, who was a scary holy person, you know, but there is something about a sense of letting myself fall apart, and even if it means, you know, even if it means ending up in some kind of like real despair, but it's a guided sense of, but underneath that despair there is no despair. It's like
right.
An old wrestler Chassid once told me in Eretz Yisrael, he said to me, "Ein shum yesh boilam klal, afilu kishayesh yeyush."
Right.
Even when there's, okay, you can hit a darg of yeyush, but then it's not about pulling yourself. It's not about pulling myself out of it. It's about allowing myself to go there and not being afraid, because the more I'm allowing myself to be there, the more I can get comfortable with it. Mm. Now, granted, like, this is what I do with clients. This is also not something I just like dreamed up one day. I've been in my own psychotherapy. But this is very much what Carl Jung discovered in his life, somewhere towards the midpoint towards the end of his life, where his most seminal work was something known as the Red Book. And what he did was, the first part of his life was very intellectual, and all these ideas about the internal world of a person, and very involved in politics. And he got to a point where he realized that he had not allowed himself to look at the darker parts of himself, and he was terrified, and allowed himself to do it, and wrote about it, and allowed himself to go into those darker parts, and came out the other side a completely transformed human being. So that's to me, that's what works for me. But at the very least, conceptually, to go back to what you're writing about, what I think you're writing about, and what you're getting at, and what we're talking about, is this concept of Hashem is here, right? Uncle Moshe's song, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. To find the mechanism within myself where I'm able to see that there's one tiny little extra capacity for something more than whatever this yeyush or whatever this marishchayra might be, that's emunah. That is precisely what emunah is. That's where I discover the Rabbeinu Shlomo, even if I'm not davening in that moment. But like, if anyone who's ever experienced a low point and then has been able to move beyond or transform themselves in any kind of way, that's tasting the Rabbeinu Shlomo. That's it, right? So it might not sound like Hashem, you might not think it's Hashem, your Rebbe never told you it's Hashem, but to me, that is the energy of where Hashem exists inside of me. That's Hashem working through me, for me, about me. That's the personal connection I have with God, is everything that I've become. That's it. So to be able to go back to that place where I'm able to sometimes strip away everything and say, the reason why I'm able to do all that is because I have a neshama inside of me. Every human being has that capacity. Every human being has a spark of God in them. The difference between a Jewish neshama and a not Jewish neshama, that's a whole, obviously a whole discussion, but that's God. That to me is God. That's the greatest manifestation of God, is growth, capacity, opportunity, the unknown, the scary unknown, the exciting unknown, the when that happens together, all of that.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm curious about, I think that's it's really incredible, and it's a little bit of a different angle than the way I write about it, which is why I'm so glad to be having this conversation. I think they're in no way mutually exclusive, and there's a lot of similarity, but it's a different angle, and I really, it's really, really resonating with me very, very deeply. I'm wondering how a person accesses that, or how you would frame that, not from the context of when a person is having a hard time or in a down moment. Because actually the truth is, in some ways, there's pros and cons in both contexts, but in some ways it's actually a little bit more natural to access or sense the unknown when we're really down, because then the potential of growth is calling us, right? Because things are broken. So the potential for something to be fixed is there, and the growth and renewal. How does a person who is feeling good, is feeling satisfied, is life is going well, life is good, right? As psychotherapists, we're always, you know, thinking about the problems. But when someone's good, where do they find that unknown and that connection, that personal experiential relationship to God, you know, in that context of life?
Sure. So you tell me what you think about this. I think that the cliche phrase is like living in gratitude, but I think, you know, I was just talking about this with my wife this morning. We had a very rare moment where I had a few minutes before I was going to my office, and she was still home also, and we went outside. We had planted seeds because some of the grass like just hadn't grown in and whatever. So we had planted seeds, and we were looking at the grass grow, you know, watching your grass grow. And there was just a moment of, there was a breeze in the air. The sun was there. We were both standing on the porch. And the question was like, can both of us stop for a moment and just be there and just experience it? The beauty of it, the beauty of anything, the beauty of at a bar mitzvah, the beauty of hustling down, you know, grocery shopping before Yontif, whatever it might be. But is there any way that I can experience the goodness of this moment? If I can, then that's also a gift from God. Right? That maybe goes back to this question of the scientist and the poet, where the scientist can explain all of the intricate details of how it works, but the poet is experiencing it. Right. And that the experience of it is where you find God. Mm. And I think maybe that's more of what you were writing about.
Yeah. 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 That's beautiful. I would maybe add slightly to it. I think it's the same thing. Building off of the way you were framing it before about kind of sensing the unknown, at least speaking just from my experience, I think that in those moments, those kind of beautiful moments, there is a sense that the beauty of this experience, the enchantment of the experience, the sweetness of the experience somehow goes beyond, there's something unknown about it that's beyond what the actual physical experience can capture.
Precisely. Right.
So in the down moments, that unknown appears to us in the sense of the potential for growth, the potential for healing, the potential for change, and the potential for things getting better, to put it kind of, you know, just lemaisa. Right. In the good moments, the unknown presents in the sense that the sweetness and the beauty of it kind of calls to us from something even beyond what we can explain.
Yeah, no, but I think the word you used was enchantment. I think that's precisely. It's like, you know, Hakaras HaTayif has also become somewhat of a cliche thing, but it's almost like you have to have Hakaras HaTayif that you have the capacity to experience enchantment. Right?
Yeah.
Because that's, I think you're right. I think that's it. The ability to be enchanted. You know, it reminds me, I don't know how far out we can go, but it reminds me of what Heschel writes about radical amazement, to live in a state of radical amazement, like to be amazed, you know?
Yeah.
Wow. And I could think of a few people in my life who, like, when you talk to them, they get like, wow. And it's like, really, you didn't know that? But the answer is, yeah, they did, but they're living in a state of amazement. I'll tell you a quick story. I shared with you that I know Rav Moshe Weinberger from the bungalow from many, many years ago. And we used to do Shal Shuddis together in the shul. They would announce, you know, Shal Shuddis was 35 minutes before Ma'ariv. And, you know, the way Shal Shuddis goes in many, many places. So 12 guys would get together, and one guy would bring the iced coffee that his wife made the Sunday before, and one guy would bring, you know, stale tuna fish, and this guy had herring in the fridge from there, and they had some little ends of challah. Yeah. And then they would sing three songs, and then every week it was a rotation. Somebody would get up and say Dvar Torah. So I remember one week they asked me, and I got up, and as I was getting up to say whatever Dvar Torah, like Rabbi Weinberger was sitting there. And there was like this momentary pause of like, I would think I was 21 or 22. It's like, what am I doing? Like, this didn't fit. But he listened. He listened the whole time. And he said, Shkoyach. And then the same thing happened a few years later. And it happened a few years later than that. And it dawned on me in my mind, oh, he heard the Kedushas Levi that I said. He knew the Naim al-Melech. He knew it. But he was living in a state in that moment of like, I'm not, it's not that I'm listening to you, Yitzi, to give you kavod. I'm living in a state of what's gonna come out of his mouth. What's he right. saying? Looking right. forward. I'm open. I'm in the state of possibly being awed. It's a very vulnerable state, and it's a very vulnerable way to live. But to live like that is how people can experience gratitude.
Yeah.
And that's how you can, that's the only way you can really, I think, you can live a life where you can discover God, Hashem. Like, yeah, there is something beyond me. There's something beyond this moment. It's not just about the trees. And it's not just about the words that the Noam HaMelech said. I want to hear how you say it. The way you say it is going to say something different to me. And how I'm going to hear it on this Shabbos is going to be different than how I heard it last year that Shabbos, whatever.
It's just amazing. It's making me think of a new way of understanding the well known Gemara about Eino Dome Shona Halacha. I think Mea Pamim le Shona Mea Ve'Echad. Right, you can't compare a person who learned something 100 times to someone who learned it 101 times. So there's many pshatim on this, and what I'm saying now is certainly not the pasha pshat, the simple interpretation. But I've never thought about it like this before. But hearing you talk about this, what I'm thinking about is, you can't compare a person who's learned it 100 times to the person who's learned it 100 times and one time, meaning 100 times means that I've learned it one time, which was the first time. And now each time I learn it, it's no longer the first time. Right. It's the 20th time. It's the 60th time. It's the 100th time. Right. 101 times, it doesn't mean 101. It means I learned it 100 times, but now when I learn it, it's the first time again. It's mea pamim ve'echad. It's 100 times, and then again a first time, not 101, but 101st.
Right. It's such a beautiful pshat in that Gemara. Yeah. Yeah. I like
it. So maybe just as a last question I'd love to hear your thoughts on. Some people come to this more naturally. This kind of consciousness of curiosity, this sense that there's something more, the intuition that there's something unknown. And a lot of people can't really access that very easily. I'm curious, you know, you mentioned before that you think about psychotherapy a lot and your practice with clients a lot from a developmental standpoint. I'm sure you can probably take this question in 100 ways, but maybe you could take it any way you want, but I'm wondering maybe in terms of developmental stages and what can happen in a person's upbringing that kind of gets in the way of this developing, you know, what are some of those factors, and how does a person who doesn't come to this naturally, how do they access this part of themselves?
Well, I think I'm not sure if you're asking me what kinds of things can happen in upbringing that would cut someone off from being able to experience this.
I guess what I was thinking about, but again, you could take it any way you want. What I was thinking about is, you know, even the phrase you mentioned before of kind of arrested development, right? So in terms of developmental stages, which happen, you know, in terms of a certain sequence, and things can, you know, create a stifling of that development.
For sure. So I'm a very big fan of a woman named Jonas Webb, Dr. Jonas Webb. She wrote a few books. They're very underrated. They're also, in my few conversations I've had with her, they're very understated too. She has much, much more to give than what she's written in her books. But she wrote a book called Running on Empty. And the book is about the effects of childhood emotional neglect. And what she writes in there very aptly is that most of us, I think today, think about psychotherapy. We'll use psychotherapy as a springboard. Sure. We're not just talking about therapy here. But most of us think of trauma. And trauma is the presence of something that has affected us. And we can turn back to it and say, you know, that instance where that person did A, B, and C, that messed me up. And we could work on the flashbacks and the memories and whatever kind of fun tools we have. The problem with childhood emotional neglect is that we're talking about the absence of something that wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're talking about the absence of something that wasn't, how do I know that it wasn't there? How do I know what it is? That what am I looking for, etc. I do think that the more that I think about her work and the more that I think about that concept and the more that I work with clients, the more I see, and I think it gets harder and harder as we live so much with such busy lives and so much paying attention to technology and all the different things that we're involved in, especially living, most of us live in cities and there's so many different things that are going on, social events and et cetera. I'm not even talking about pathology. I'm just talking about the basic life that we have.
Yeah.
What is the threshold that each one of our children need to be able to feel that their experience in life is valid? I'm not talking about that it's correct. I mean, it's a valid life. It's a viable life that matters. I think that people who have experienced enough of that in their childhood have so much more resiliency and so much more curiosity. And the people who don't end up becoming either very closed off to that, this whole world that we're talking about of the capacity for enchantment, curiosity. Life becomes very intense, very busy. Sometimes it ends up in craving and addiction and searching and yearning in ways that are just not healthy. But I think to me, the number one thing that is important is for each one of our children to be able to grow up knowing at their stages, and this is not an easy thing to do, but for each one of our children to know that their experience in life matters to me. Before I place a judgment on you, my child, on what you did, I'm first going to listen to you. I might yell and scream about what you did. I might tell you, know, like, it's the worst thing you ever did. But first I want to hear you. First I want to understand you. First I want to be able to hear what you're doing. My daughter always says to me, Daddy, you're being a therapist, you're being a therapist. So that's our cute little joke. I hope that's not really true. I hope I'm not being a therapist. But yeah, like, I just want to know. I just want to know. I'm curious. I want to bring that curiosity to my kids. Because if they can experience that their experience is viable and matters, then they have the capacity to think, to be autonomous, to grow into their own individuals, to find their own way, to be curious, to develop some form of their own conscientiousness. I can teach them all I want about what's right and wrong. But if I want them to be able to make choices in their lives, they have to know that they have the ability to make choices. And that ability only comes from a sense of autonomy. Hmm. And that's my job as a parent. So to answer your question, I think besides the conventional stuff like trauma and moving around too much and all that, you know, I think that curiosity only comes when people have the capacity to feel like they matter. And curiosity is what's needed for enchantment. Curiosity is what's needed for seeing beyond, finding opportunities. You know, curiosity to me is the greatest way to get. I could speak for myself. You know, when I was a young kid, I was very curious about these things. I read a lot of, you know, Varya Kaplan. When I was like 14, I sat down and read like all that I can get. I was just curious about it. I didn't know that that would like serve me well as I grew up, but like curiosity really matters. You talked about a painting you have in your wall. I have a sign. Take this as you will, as a therapist. My mother bought me this sign. It says, it's a quote from Walt Whitman. It says, "Be curious, not judgmental." It's the only like saying I have in my office. You know, be curious, not judgmental. I think it says "Dare to Dream." I have a little plaque that says that, but that's the big sign.
Yeah.
Curiosity.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. So my last question then is, so a person who didn't get that and doesn't have that naturally, how in adult life can they bring out that part of themselves, or how can they work towards it?
I would tell you that I can't answer that because I'm a therapist and it's too close to home. And it's too close to home insofar as is like, I know what I do as a therapist. And, you know, the short answer is go see a therapist. No. And like, but like, really, there's a lot of ideas that are out there. I just, you know, I find that it's hard to pinpoint particular advice to answer that question. I think depending on the state of how much a person struggles in life, that determines whether or not they should or shouldn't see a therapist. But you know, Dr. Webb thinks that a person who spends more time getting to know themselves emotionally, and she has all these different techniques that people can like look through to take your emotions more seriously and learn about your emotions. You know, that's a very, very true idea. I tend to think more existentially, as you might gather, you know, like I'm thinking about like the neshama and like recognizing that Hashem loves you and all that. But how to develop your own curiosity, how to develop the vulnerability to be curious. You know, I wouldn't know how to answer that. Like that's a much larger discussion. I mean, I can tell you the theories of psychotherapy and how I work and all that, but that's in the process of therapy.
Yeah. Okay. I appreciate that answer. It reminds me of, I don't know if this is exactly what you mean, but it reminds me, you mentioned Jung before I have not read all that much, but there's a line from him that I really like, something to the effect of, in the practical practice of psychotherapy, there are no rules or recipes, only individual people.
Right. Precisely.
So how would you help someone develop curiosity? I have no idea until I meet them, I'm sitting with them. Right. Yeah. And then it unfolds, which really actually makes so much sense, because that is what curiosity means. And so to believe that I could have a model for how to develop curiosity would be almost oxymoronic.
Precisely. You said exactly what I meant to say.
Right. It reminds me of the saying of the Yira Kadosh, which certainly sounds quite controversial and provocative. What he said, that in the service of God, there are no rules, and this itself is no rule.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. So much of what you've shared is just really, really resonating with me, and something I'm sure I'll think a lot more about. And you articulated it so deeply and really beautiful. Thank you.
It's an opportunity for me to in a way reflect back to that, I think so much of what you wrote in this book was like, you know, the book I didn't write, like, this is like, it's so up my alley. And it's, you know, I don't know, I'll share this with you. I don't know if you want to include this in the recording. This is a thought I had. I know it's late, but it's right before Shavuos. Bekitzer.
Yeah, please.
You have to just use, you have to allow yourself to use your imagination for this. But, you know, Klal Yisrael said Nasiv and Ishma right before the Torah. And the basic question is, you know, Hashem went around to all the different nations of the world and they all asked Maksiv Bey. And each nation, the Medrash says, Hashem told them the one thing he knew would be the hardest for them. And then the Gemara relates that the Shem Shmuel says that there's actually a taina on Klal Yisrael why we never asked Maksiv Bey. We should have asked Maksiv Bey. Why did? So this is a thought that I had. I'll share this with you. And I think it's relevant to everything that we're talking about. When the Rebbeinu Shalom created Adam, so he said Nasa Adam. And the whole Welt has to figure this out. Rashi talks about it. It's a Welt Kasha.
Sure.
Who is he talking to?
Right.
We're create man. So the Baal Shem Tov responds very uniquely. And he says that Hashem was talking to Adam. He was talking to Adam. And he was saying to Adam, you and I are both going to create you. We're going to become Shutfen in the Maisa Bereshis. I am not going to create you whole. I'm going to create you fragmented, chaotic, missing. You're going to have to fill in the blanks. You're going to have to bring the potential Menakoch El Apoil. And you're also going to have to figure out how to be a Baal Bechira. You're also going to have to figure out all these things in life. That's up to you. And that's part of your Shleimus. Part of your Shleimus is the Sveikus and the darkness. You're going to have to figure that all out. So I'm thinking to myself that the Umas HaOlam, when they heard the Torah, they heard in their minds, Hashem was saying, whoever's going to be Mekabel my Torah, they're going to be the Mamlechus Kohen of Goy Kadosh. Klal Yisrael didn't hear that. Ki hu zeh. They didn't hear anything like that. All they heard was an echo of Nasa Adam. Mm-hmm. Nasa Adam, Nasa Adam. And they responded, Nasa Adam. Nasa. Hineni, Nasa. Hashem said, I was like, now you're ready for the Torah. The Torah begins with my capacity to say, I'm looking for you. I want to find you. I recognize that there's something more here. There's some enchantment, like something. So that's why they never asked Maksiv Bey. It didn't even, it was never Oyla B'daitecha.
Wow.
Nasa.
And
so,
and without asking Maksiv Bey, it leaves it open and it leaves it for the imagination and the curiosity, sure, of the unknown. Amazing. Sure. That I never heard the tzushtel of the Nasa Adam and Nasa Venishmas. That's really
okay.
A lot to think about. Thank you so much. So good. So good to really meet you more, and God willing, more.
Okay. Looking forward.
Take care. Thank you.
Good to see you.
So much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please follow us on WhatsApp, YouTube, or Instagram. All our podcast series can be found wherever you listen to podcasts. I'd love to hear from you, so please reach out with questions, comments, or suggestions, or to be added to our WhatsApp groups. You can reach us through email using yakov.attached@gmail.com or on WhatsApp at 773-888-2413.